Secretary Tinituville, in Elvish her name meant the soft tinkling of silver bells, melodious but unceasing, somewhere in the back of one's head, was worried about the egg whisk. She'd interviewed the scouts, who repeated what they'd said before. Out back of one of the new human dwellings, on the south bank of the Mouthwash, just down the road from the dark tower of Snorfang, they'd come across a shiny new trash can. Inside it, among the other wonders too bizarre to contemplate, they'd found the machine. They had no idea what it was, but felt it was their duty to bring it back for the boss to see. They had no idea how to find out whether it was loaded or not, so they brought it home in a bucket of water, just in case. Right, Tinituville had said. What other wonders? You don't want to know, the scouts had told her. They're too bizarre to... well, if you insist. There were bags, wrought of some shining white fabric that was smoother than silk, thinner than gossamer, of a weave so fine that you could neither see nor feel the weft. Most remarkable of all, moisture. There were lots of wet, sticky things in the trash can. Didn't seem to soak into it, but rather was repelled, as by the finest oilcloth. There were perfect cylinders of fine steel, like helmets, but no bigger than a goblin's handspan, closed at one end, roughly cut open at the other. There were small trays made of... Here the scouts fell to arguing among themselves, one claiming that it must be some sort of fungus, the other plumping for a kind of inedible bread. Anyway, it was white and light as a feather, and if you bent it, it snapped like a dry twig. And wrapped round these trays were shreds of an unearthly transparent substance, soft and pliable, the colour of slug trail, like very thin sheets of dry water. Yes, well, we told you it was too bizarre to contemplate, but no, you had to know best. And you found all this, Tinituville asked, in the trash? Yes, because in the same receptacle were apple cores and chicken bones and potato peel and a sort of gravelly breakfast cereal stuff that tasted tantalizingly of cat. Evidently all stuff they'd slung out as being of neither use nor value. All that and this machine. The trash can hadn't even been padlocked, showing how trusting these humans were. Thank you, Tinituville had said, then remembered she was an elf. Go away, I'm busy. The scouts bowed low and backed away, muttering something under their breath in an obscure goblin dialect she found it expedient to let people believe she didn't understand. Ever since then she'd sat silently, multitasking, the egg whisk lying on the desk in front of her. Who were these people? Just humans, that was all. Crass, ignorant, marginally prettier than goblins, most of them. But looks aren't everything. And in all other departments there wasn't a lot between them, except that goblins were often brave, intermittently loyal, and solidly based around a handful of core values. Nasty, but core. Which as often as not they'd rather die than betray. Humans, as had often been observed, would sell their own grandmothers, although only other humans would be foolish enough to buy them, even with an extended warranty. Above all, though, humans were dumb. To them, the white heat of technology meant burning their fingers on a tinderbox. human inventions, human achievements in the field of technology? Name one. Right. Knew you couldn't. And yet, humans had built this extraordinary egg whisk. The other stuff the scouts had talked about was probably fantasy, the products of overheated goblin imagination. Transparent, clingy, filmy stuff, for crying out loud. Who could possibly believe in that? But the whisk was something she could see and touch. She had no choice but to believe in it. And if they could make that, just think of the weapons they'd be capable of producing. Or had already produced. Advanced military hardware is, wait for it, a two-edged sword. You can get hold of it and use it on your enemies, or your enemies can get hold of it and use it on you. You have two alternatives only, and inertia isn't one of them. Oh, damn, she thought. I'm going to have to do something. And quickly, before someone else does it. And sneakily, of course. Goes without saying. Well, the first thing she needed was solid, reliable information. No use, in that case, sending more goblin scouts. She needed observations from someone with a brain larger and marginally less dense than a walnut. A dwarf? Since Mordak's epoch-making treaty of bad-tempered tolerance with King Drain, there were a few dwarves on the payroll. Moderately smart? No, make that cunning. And sending a dwarf to investigate the possibilities of new and deadly forms of weapon was like asking a cat to babysit fledgling sparrows. It had to be an elf. An elf, furthermore, with energy, intelligence, resourcefulness, and the determination to see the mission through. Oh, damn, she said aloud. Still, she'd defined the parameters herself, and there was only one candidate who was currently wearing her underwear. She sighed and reached for a scrap of paper. Mordak. Gone out. Back later. Maybe sometime. Don't, whatever you do, attempt to file anything, make appointments or answer letters. Do not move anything that we may conceivably want to find ever again. T. Experience had taught her that the best way of slipping quietly out of the palace was to go up to the 14th level, ride back down to the 17th level on the service elevator, cut across through the Museum of Cultural Artifacts, and take the back stairs direct to the East Gate. As she paused for breath on the level 12 landing, she heard some sort of commotion on the far side of the massive steel door. She hesitated. If there was a problem, she ought to stay and sort it out. Before Mordak made a mess of it that she would have to clear up later. But that would take time, and that was a commodity which she suspected was in short supply if she wanted to get to the whiskmakers before anyone else. She shrugged and carried on up the stairs, and in due course emerged into the sunlight. There was, of course, a sentry on duty outside the East Gate. He was covered from head to foot in black cloth, apart from his eyes, which were in there somewhere behind two 2-inch-thick discs of smoked glass held together with wire. Goblins don't like sunlight much. You, she said, get me a horse. The sentries all knew her by sight and by the sting of her extensive vocabulary.
Sorry, miss. No horses. Not till Tuesday.
She rolled her eyes. What?
No horses. Sorry, ma'am. Wolves and flying lizards only, till Tuesday.
What happened?
Well, your ladyship, somebody thought it would be a good idea to save money by amalgamating the Royal Messenger Service and the Household Cavalry. Have 'em share the same stables, that sort of thing.
She knew that.
She'd forged Mordack's signature on the order.
Well?
The Household Cavalry ride wolves, Your Grace. So, no horses. Not till Tuesday.
She sighed.
Fine, get me a winged lizard. Now.
After all, she said to herself, how hard can it be? The wraiths fly the horrid things, and they aren't even there.
And the lizards were held to be sentient and telepathic, and anything that could read her thoughts could be brought to a keener appreciation of its own shortcomings, and made to do as it was damned well told. And it was that, or walk. And it looked like rain. The sentry looked at her.
Are you quite sure about that, Your Excellency? Only they can be a bit.
Now!
The sentry didn't smile, let alone grin. But there was something about the enthusiasm with which he trotted off to obey her orders that made her wonder if the investigation couldn't wait till Tuesday after all. But it was too late now, of course. An elf doesn't back down or show nervousness in front of a goblin. And if a wraith could do it, she'd watch them, showing off. Look, no hands.
Here you go, miss.
The goblin was back, leading her trusty steed on a very long rein. It looked like two earthworms grafted onto each end of a turtle, with vast leathery wings added as an afterthought, probably using non-standard parts. She looked at it. It looked at her and winked. The goblin pushed the reins into her hands, saluted, and backed away, with the sort of utterly fixed expression on his face that could only mean that, if he relaxed just one muscle, he'd collapse into fits of uncontrollable laughter. Then a voice spoke to her inside her head. The relationship between a wraith's steed and its rider is one of the greatest and most complex mysteries in all the realms. It begins at the moment the lizard hatches, and ends, who knows when. Death is only a staging point on that shared journey. It is more than mere symbiosis. It constitutes a joining of minds and souls at a level so profound that if you were to ask where does one end and the other begin, all you would achieve would be to show how little you knew and understood. It is a welding, a mingling, a blending that simplifies rather than complicates. It is beyond dependency and love. It can only be the rejoining of two parts of one whole that should never have been sundered in the first place.
Hello, gorgeous, said the voice.
She sighed. Pack it in, she said aloud. The lizard sniggered and nuzzled her thigh with its nose.
Do you want to ride me?
It said, not in her head, but in the very recesses of her soul, worse luck.
I think I'd like that very much.
She closed her eyes, counted to 10, picked up a fair-sized rock, and bashed the lizard's head with it.
Oh,
said the innermost fibre of her being.
You can do that again any time you like.
She whimpered. But what the hell? The walk would do her good. She tied the reins to the massive bronze knocker of the great gate, hitched up her socks, and started to walk towards the distant eaves of the forest.
She hadn't gone more than a few yards when a horrible tearing noise, followed by a crash, made her stop and spin round. The lizard was trotting after her, dragging one of the black gates behind it on the end of its rein.
"Wait for me,"
said the quintessence of her existence.
"Go away."
"Can't. We are joined. Nothing will ever part us. Talking of which, what are you doing after you get off work?"
Elves don't swear or scream or have hysterics or burst into floods of tears. When confronted with the inevitable, they proceed with a cold, calm dignity, together with a steely resolve to take it out on the next member of an inferior species, unfortunate enough to cross their path. "Fine," she said. "If I'm stuck with you, I suppose you'd better make yourself useful." "Oh, come on," she added, as the lizard sank to its knees and wiggled its hindquarters. "You can do better than that. Here, twist your head round a bit more so I can stand on it." She was wearing her 4-inch stiletto heels. Unfortunately, the lizard really liked that. The flood of pink goo subsided to a steady flow, then a trickle. When he judged it was safe to do so, Mordack cautiously let go of the iron ring, then the science officer's ear.
"Well then," he said, "that's all right."
"Say what?"
"I think it's stopped now," Mordack said slowly and clearly. "Crisis over."
Brave words. He had no idea what volume of the stuff had washed past him and gone down the ventilation duct, but he had an idea it was going to be sticky underfoot in levels 13 to 27 for a day or so, and he didn't want to think about what would happen to productivity if the stuff had managed to find its way into the winch mechanism or the elevator shafts. The smell, likewise, was going to take quite a bit of getting used to. Still, as far as he could tell at this stage, there was no irreparable harm done. And they'd managed to prove beyond reasonable doubt that creating a female goblin was impossible, which advanced the sum of goblin knowledge one tiny step further, and good science is never wasted.
"What the hell's that?"
The science officer was pointing up the corridor. Unfortunately, his newly enlarged ear was blocking Mordack's view. He folded it down out of the way and saw...
"Oh, darn,"
he muttered. The first and most obvious thing was the sheer size. Twice the height of the tallest goblin he'd ever seen. Taller even than a human, or an elf. And monstrously broad in the shoulders, chest and thighs. Gigantic muscles knotted under the coal-black skin, and the legs were straight and unbowed, the knees unknocked, so that it strode rather than scuttled. The only really goblin thing about it, in fact, was the tusks and the little red piggy eyes.
"What are those things on its front?" Mordack whispered. "That can't be right, surely."
"Cayenne pepper," said the science officer.
"You just can't be too careful with that stuff."
The monster advanced on them, stopped and looked down at them, blinking confusedly. Then, with a lunge so quick that Mordack never knew it was coming, it grabbed the science officer round the throat, lifted him off the ground, held him up, nose to snout, and bared its dreadful teeth. It growled, and his voice was as deep and menacing as an earthquake.
"I want my mummy," it said.